Hello, everyone. Welcome once again to the Ways of Faith podcast. Today is Wednesday, November 4th, and we celebrate today the memorial of one of my favorite saints, St. Charles Borromeo, who was a bishop and a cardinal who lived during the 1500s in a very, very tumultuous and difficult time in the life of the church in Italy, where he was, in Milan, Italy. There was a lot of corruption. There was a lot of the clergy were not well educated, unfortunately. They were oftentimes acting in ways that was very unbefitting of a clergy member. The lay people did not know their faith very well at all, and there was a lot of vice and sin rampant in that diocese. And the young bishop, very young, 24 years old, because his uncle was the pope and made him the bishop and cardinal of Milan, Italy, Charles Borromeo made a decision at that point. He could have lived a life of great luxury and ease and comfort, which was unfortunately rather common for bishops at that time, because they wielded a lot of power in the secular world as well as in the spiritual realm. But he made a choice to be holy and to do things according to God's law and God's will. And so he set about immediately when he got to Milan, reforming the church as best as he could. And he started with his own clergy, his priests, and encouraging them to be holier and to grow closer to God and to be, you know, better trained and better educated in knowing their own faith and also how to be good priests. And he was pretty tireless in his work of trying to renew the church, and it had great effect. One of the things that St. Charles Borromeo would always talk about is how reform starts with me. Reform of the church, reform of renewal in the church and her members starts with each member taking responsibility for their own relationship with God and striving to be better and to be holier by staying close to the Lord. So we thank the Lord for St. Charles Borromeo and the great renewal and reform that he brought during a very difficult time in the life of the church. I'd like to finish up talking about the sacrament of marriage, and then we'll be finished with the sacraments. And then, if I have time, to start talking about what are called the four last things. Okay. Now, I believe I did talk about this in an earlier podcast, but I want to come back to it and circle back around to it because of the fact of November being a month that is oftentimes set aside specifically for prayers for the dead, for prayers for those who have died, those who are in purgatory. So I thought it would be helpful to kind of circle back and talk about those things a little bit as an encouragement for us, and then move on to a new topic next week, okay? So to finish our discussion on marriage, a couple of things that I'd like to say that I don't believe I've said yet, although it's possible that I have. I've done enough of these podcasts now that I'm starting to forget what I've already talked about. So I apologize if some of this is review, okay? We talked about annulments. We talked about how they work and kind of how to understand them, okay? I'd like to talk a little bit about matrimonial consent today. Because that is usually the question that is it's always the question that is at issue typically when the church is investigating a marriage that unfortunately has broken down as to whether or not it may have been null from the beginning. What's under examination, what's being studied is the exchange of marital consent between the two parties. And what was their mindset at the time? What was their understanding at the time? What was their intention at the time? Okay, so we probably need to talk about marital consent a bit and then talk a little bit about what marriage in the Catholic Church looks like and why. Right. So the first thing, and I know I've mentioned this before, but just as a refresher, marriage is different from the other six sacraments in the fact that in marriage, the couple bestow the sacrament on each other, okay? So the priest or the deacon or the bishop is there to witness their exchange of vows and to accept that act of consent on behalf of the church as good, valid binding. So you could kind of think of it like if somebody was going to enter into a contract with somebody else, a business contract, and you had a mediator there to make sure that all of the I's were dotted, all the T's were crossed, that it was a valid contract, that everybody, you know, did what they were supposed to do. That's kind of the role of the priest or the deacon at the wedding, is to make sure the vows are exchanged in the way that they're supposed to be, that in a way that the church would recognize as her own, as valid and binding and good. And so then to accept that consent that the couple exchanges, but the couple bestows the sacrament on them, on each other. Okay. The husband bestows the sacrament on his wife and the wife on her husband. They do that through what's called a free act of consent, right? This is the exchange of vows. So the central moment, and I mean, we know this instinctually anyway, but the central moment of the celebration of any marriage is the exchange of vows, because that is where the couple is vowing themselves to one another, making a sacred vow of giving themselves totally to the other and receiving the gift of the other person that they are making to them. Okay. So specifically when, you know, the husband or the wife says the vows, I take you to be my husband, I take you to be my wife. Or we can also do it where the priest or the deacon asks each of them, do you take so-and-so to be your wife or to be your husband? And they say, I do. And they consent to that. Okay. So that exchange of consent is absolutely necessary for a valid marriage to exist, because that's what makes marriage, is consent. It's the beautiful reality that as human beings created in God's image and likeness, we have free will. We have an intellect that can process things and analyze things and ponder things and evaluate things and then make a decision. And what's happening on a wedding day is that a husband and a wife, each of them have pondered, hopefully, and deeply considered whether or not this is the person that they want to bind themselves to in a unique relationship for the rest of their lives. And then they actually do that. Okay. And of course, between two baptized Christians, it's also a sacrament. And so God seals or binds them with his grace, okay, when they exchange that consent. I'd like to share with you just a little bit of what the Code of Canon Law, the church's law book, has to say about this. So this is not the Code of Canon Law. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, a different big book. And this is starting at paragraph 1625, okay? All right. It says, the parties to a marriage covenant are a baptized man and woman, free to contract marriage, who freely express their consent. To be free means, first, not to be under any constraint, second, not impeded by any natural or ecclesiastical law. All of that is established in marriage preparation. You know, the priest makes sure that, like, for example, they're not closely related to one another. That would be what's called an impediment to getting married. You can't marry a close relative, okay, for obvious reasons. Or that they haven't been married before, okay? They don't have a pre-existing marriage that is unresolved, because you can only be married to one person at a time, right? 1626 talks about the church holds the exchange of consent between the spouses to be the indispensable element that makes the marriage. If consent is lacking, there is no marriage. Okay? So if somebody's acting in a way that in which they are not free, if they're being forced to marry and they don't want to do it, then there's no real exchange of consent. They might actually say the words, but not mean it. Okay? And so the church is saying it has to be a free choice that the husband and the wife make, and they express that through their vows that they exchange, okay? And then the church gives us a very specific definition, kind of almost a scientific definition of what consent itself is. In 1627 of the Catechism, it says, the consent consists in, quote, a human act by which the partners mutually give themselves to each other, I take you to be my wife. I take you to be my husband. This consent that binds the spouses to each other finds its fulfillment in the two becoming one flesh. All right. And then 1628, the consent must be an act of the will of each of the contracting parties, free of coercion or grave external fear, you know, so no shotgun weddings, right? No human power can substitute for this consent. If this freedom is lacking, the marriage is invalid. Now, that would have to be proven, okay? One or the other of the spouses can't just simply claim it to be the case if their marriage breaks down, for example, to say, well, I wasn't free, so my marriage is invalid. No, that needs to be proven through an annulment process, okay? And that's to protect and preserve the dignity and sanctity of marriage so that it's not something that is easily discarded or set aside, okay? There's some further requirements specifically for Catholics, all right? Since the 1500s, it is required for Catholics, if both or even just one of the parties to the marriage is Catholic, okay, and then by that I mean baptized Catholic or received into the Catholic Church later if they were baptized like as a Lutheran or something, sometime before the marriage they, you know, joined the church and became Catholic, they must get married in a Catholic church before a Catholic minister, priest, or deacon, unless they have explicit permission not to do that, okay? If a Catholic marries outside of the church, so that would be like justice of the peace, or gets married at a Protestant church in front of a Protestant minister without that permission, then the Catholic Church sees that marriage as null and void from the beginning and cannot recognize it as a valid marriage, okay? This is what's called canonical form. Form as in F-O-R-M, the canonical form of marriage. And what that means is that the canonical means the church's law, canon law, the lawful form of entering into a marriage, okay? Now, for this reason, when a Catholic gets married outside of the church without the express permission of the bishop, which can be gained in certain circumstances, okay, then that marriage is invalid, okay? And there's a need for that marriage to be validated, to be regularized, and that process is called convalidation. Another word that's often used is that a couple says, we need to get our marriage blessed in the church because we got married outside of the church. And that's fine. I mean, I think people kind of know what that means, but it's really a lot more than that. It's not just blessing. It's the actual marriage needs to take place in the church, in the sense of a new marriage ceremony will take place where there's an exchange of vows in front of a priest, etc. And in the eyes of the church, that's when their marriage bond actually begins. So they may be married in the eyes of the state, if they got married at the justice of the peace, for example, but not in the eyes of the church. Okay? Why would the church have such kind of a strict rule? It's to protect the couple, actually, and to protect the dignity of the sacrament of marriage, both of those things. It comes from the Council of Trent in the mid-1500s, this requirement that if a Catholic is going to get married either to another Catholic or to a non-Catholic, that they must be married in front of their parish priest or another priest delegated by him, you know. And two witnesses, because at that time in the 1500s, there was the practice of what are called clandestine marriages or secret marriages. You know, this is the practice of eloping, right? Where the couple runs off and gets married, okay? And especially at this time, remember the Council of Trent, this is right after the Protestant Reformation. So you have couples who run off and get married by a former Catholic who is now perhaps a Lutheran minister, right? And then they come back home and say, hey, everybody, we're married, you know, come celebrate with us. And everybody's surprised, but happy for them. But the problem is there's no record of this. So when there's a clandestine marriage, if a couple runs off and gets married in secret, which would happen a lot of times, especially when the parents didn't approve, and that was a lot more common back then because of the fact that the parents were more involved in arranging the marriages, okay? if the parents didn't approve, and so you have a Romeo and Juliet kind of a moment where they run off together and get married, okay, you have a problem because there's no documentation of that having taken place. And what we believe about marriage is that a real bond is created between them. So what would happen is a couple would come back claiming to be married, and then, heaven forbid, if and when the marriage would break down or go sour, one or the other parties, a lot of times the man, would say, well, we were never really married. You know, we were never really married. And there's no, and the wife would say, could say, well, sure we were. And he would say, prove it. Well, now you have a problem, right? Because of the church's insistence based on God's plan for marriage that you can't be married again. You can't be married twice. So you have a marriage situation that there's no way to prove whether that marriage actually occurred in a valid way or not. And so if the marriage breaks down, now what do you do? Because if they really are bound to each other, if they really did get married, even though it was secret, you can't hardly let them get married again. But if what, for example, the husband is claiming is true, that they never actually were married, then they are free to marry. But there's no way to find out. And marriage is a very serious matter. You got, now you have children involved potentially, and you know, it can become an incredibly painful mess for people. So what the church did is to say, okay, the Catholic Church, we have authority over how the sacraments are to be celebrated. Not the sacraments themselves, as far as the church can't change, like, for example, that, you know, at Mass, that bread and wine are needed for the Eucharist. Okay, that comes from the Lord himself. But, you know, how the Mass is celebrated, as far as, like, the procedure and, you know, okay, this is how you start, and then you have this part, and then you have this part. The church has the authority to determine that. So she has the authority to determine what is necessary for a valid sacrament, for a sacrament to be recognized as having been celebrated validly in a way that is true, okay? So in the 1500s, the Council of Trent said, all right, we cannot put up with this clandestine marriage practice anymore because it's damaging the church and it's harmful to people. It's leaving people abandoned and unsure of their state before the church in the eyes of God, of, well, am I married or not, right? So the church said, this is so serious that we are going to make a requirement that any Catholic who gets married, unless they have specific permission otherwise, must get married in the presence of a Catholic minister, priest or deacon, with two witnesses. Or if they don't, the church will not recognize that contract as valid and binding. They're not truly married in the eyes of the church. Okay? That rule still holds today. Right? And so it's an important reminder for us of why it's so important to get married in the church. Well, of course, because it's the church is where we celebrate the sacraments, but also for the assurance that this marriage is truly valid, right? Because like people are getting, unfortunately, incredibly, you could call it, I guess, creative. And so, you know, when they write their own vows or they sing to each other as their quote unquote vows, and they don't actually say anything in their vows about this being a permanent relationship, this being, you know, to for the good of the spouses and raising children, then can we even really recognize it as what we would call marriage? That's the problem. That's the challenge. Okay. As far as the grace and effect of the sacrament of marriage, we haven't talked about that yet. The grace of marriage, of course, is to benefit both the husband and the wife by being channels of grace to each other. Okay, so in 1639, paragraph 1639 in the Catechism, we read this. The consent by which the spouses mutually give and receive one another is sealed by God himself. From their covenant arises an institution confirmed by the divine law, even in the eyes of society. The covenant between the spouses is integrated into God's covenant with man. Authentic married love is caught up into divine love. So what the church is saying is that the love between a husband and wife who have celebrated the sacrament of marriage is a share in the divine love that God has for us. It tells us about it, the passion that God has for us, the self-sacrifice, the love. Okay, it's a way of imitating Jesus' love for his church and his church's love for him, right? 1640, thus the marriage bond has been established by God himself in such a way that a marriage concluded and consummated between the baptized can never be dissolved. This bond, which results from the free human act of the spouses and their consummation of the marriage, is a reality. It's a real bond. Okay, it's not just like a symbolic bond, but a real bond. Henceforth irrevocable, and it gives rise to a covenant guaranteed by God's fidelity. The church does not have the power to contravene this disposition of divine wisdom. In other words, the church cannot dissolve a marriage. That's what we talked about with annulments, right? It's not the church dissolving it. It's the church saying the marriage never existed from the beginning. And then 1641, by reason of their state in life and of their order, Christian spouses have their own special gifts in the people of God. This grace proper to the sacrament of matrimony is intended to perfect the couple's love and to strengthen their indissoluble unity. By this grace from Jesus, they help one another to attain holiness in their married life and in welcoming and educating their children. So, now we have talked about all seven sacraments of the church at great length. And next week, I will go into a refresher on the four last things and talk specifically about the need to pray and sacrifice for our deceased brothers and sisters. Okay? Until then, God bless you.